With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
What's up, everybody? It's Joe LaPuma. You are listening to the Complex Sneakers Podcast. As always, I am with my guys. First off, Mr. Matt Welty. What is that? Are you drinking coffee? It's a little early.
Yeah, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, as they would say this morning.
And of course, my man, Mr. Brendan Dunn. How we doing?
I feel good. I got my Yeezy slides on. It's a quiet morning. The snow is falling. It's a new day in America.
It is a new day, and it's an early day for us. We usually record in the afternoon. We're up very, very early. Not that early, but pretty early because we got a big episode today. It's going to be a big day. I feel good. I already had the iced coffee with the espresso. That's why
I'm
talking.
How many, Joe? Just one singular?
Just one for now. I got another one on deck after the podcast. But
a venti? Is it a venti?
We do coffee bean.
Okay.
Coffee bean. In L.A., I go to the coffee bean. That's my spot. Uh-huh. And there's
one
in
Brooklyn. Do they spell your name right on the cup?
Giuseppe?
They do. Joel. Joel. Giuseppe. Yeah, no, Joel. You know what's funny is that my old Complex email used to be Joel at Complex. So people used to email, hello, Joel. Like J-O-E-L.
Joel Ortiz.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
I'm on coffee.
That ad lib was the best. That ad lib.
Shout out to Slaughterhouse. Well, how many coffees deep are you?
I'm on coffee number two.
What? Two already?
Mm-hmm.
What do you make?
What's the mug say?
What does the mug say?
I think my mom gave me this. It says relax, which is.
It looks like it says something else on there.
It's like one of those. It's like one of those live, laugh, love situations.
Really motivational.
Well, it's good advice. So, you know, sometimes you're a lot more relaxed though than you're a lot more relaxed lately. But
we all are.
It's one of those mornings where you got the workout in, but then you kind of didn't. It's so early that you didn't space out how much time it takes your body to stop sweating post workout, and you're like, I'm done working out, but I'm sitting here. Like, why am I heating up?
This is super generous because you said you got the workout at Wealthy. I don't think Joe or I did any working out this morning. This is all you, baby.
This is all you. Are the fitness guru of the podcast. I will tell you though, last week I walked up 12 flights of stairs two nights in a row. It's very tough. It's very tough.
I love this.
You in the penthouse suite or something?
I woke up. My legs are killing me.
Where were you staying that you had to...
No,
you,
in my apartment.
The calf guard was feeling shaky? How is that possible?
Let me tell you, in my apartment, the calves failed me a little bit.
That's got to be the first time that's ever happened.
I woke up so sore.
If you're listening, go to Joe's IG and take a look at his calves real quick and then tap back into the conversation. Sorry to interrupt, Joe.
I put the Nike dry fit jacket on and I said, mm-hmm. I'm going to walk to get some cardio. You know, I am not good at working out. I'm not like this guy to my right in the Zoom who – the far right, not immediate right. No shots done. You know, I put the dry fit on and I was like, I'm going to walk from my floor to the roof. And I almost didn't make it. Walking upstairs, someone was like, oh, you should run up the stairs. I said, run up the stairs. I barely made it walking. It was a good workout, but I had to take – I did it for 2 days, and then I had to take like 4 days off because I'm sore. So
I'm glad we're having this conversation because I remember Welty trying to make fun of me a few weeks back for complaining about carrying all those Sneaker of the Year book boxes up and down my stairs. Go buy a copy if you haven't yet. We're going to get some more signed ones out the door soon.
Something I want to ask you, Joe. Who do you think does the whole Nike dry fit aesthetic better? You or Drake?
I don't know, but that's good company to be in. I'm not going to comment on that.
I would say there's some sort of similarities, not like you're dressing like him or he's dressing like you or whatever. But
Welty, I don't think we dress alike, though. I think the dry fit sometimes, but in general, you don't think we
there's
do.
There's a lot of Nike track suits in your rotation, right?
That's fair to say. That's fair to say. But I don't think in general we have similar style. I like to knock the tracksuits. Did anyone get them? Did you see the new drop from yesterday?
I kind of want the mock neck, man. See, I don't know if I can walk around wearing a piece of Drake clothing, but I really like that
stuff. I feel the same way.
The yellow and black is fire, though. Did you see the yellow and black suit?
Mm-hmm.
No, Welty?
Not a Drake hater, but just like I don't feel moved enough to buy his clothing. I don't know. And me and Brendan had this talk too. It's kind of weird sometimes to buy like a jacket that's a sportswear brand because it doesn't give you as much versatile options to wear it with the footwear.
Yeah,
I still say this. No bias aside, the Kith run set. Did you ever see that?
I remember. Yeah,
I know. I've seen you wear it many times. Okay, Joe.
So Dave Matthews, super producer Dave Matthews, who's on the Zoom, will tell you. That's all I fly in for the past 4 years. And to me, the Kith run set dry fit to me is the best Nike suit that's come out in the past 4 years. It's like, and it was like a limited midnight drop, but I trapped that.
You didn't have to queue up for, which you didn't have to pay for any of that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Ronnie sends you guys stuff too. So I don't want to hear it. All right.
one jacket I think we should talk about and not go too far into detail just to know that our, expenses are a little different
at the inauguration.
Oh no, man, we got to talk
Joe hits
about
us
this.
Up over Joe hits us up over the weekend, and he bought a jacket from a former guest on the show. You can either leave that in or cut it out.
No, it was
what are we talking about?
It was done. He doesn't pay attention to text.
Joe buys a Cold Wall jacket. Shout out Samuel Ross, and he hits us on the group text, and he's like, "You guys ever buy a jacket and not look at the price, and then be like, damn, I just spent $800?" I'm like, "Nope, can't relate, Joe."
I got caught. So I went to Ama Meniere. We shot a couple episodes of the new season in Atlanta, and they had a Cold Wall jacket that is fire. It's like really, really good. So I went there and I bought it. I went to the register, and I just was a little. And by a little, I mean shocked at the price. And I wasn't going to put it back, but it was funny because, you know, you don't want to be like, oh, no, I have to take it back. But it was an expensive jacket. But I will tell you, I'm going to wear it nonstop and get my – I'm going to – see, I always say wear it nonstop. The YouTube comments say – I did the rotation. I kept saying, I've been wearing these nonstop. All the comments. How many shoes does Joe wear nonstop? Give me a break. Come on. But yeah, the jacket
like Drake in so many ways.
exactly, the nonstop pun. But yeah, that jacket. I got to get my money's worth out of it. It's a dope jacket, but I was definitely caught off guard.
I know what you mean, Joe, in terms of getting your money's worth with a good jacket. It's really important you just get the one high engagement Instagram photo with that jacket. Because I got a jacket right now that I broke out last weekend, and I got some photos of me inside jacket, but I'm not really sure that they're the right photos. And just trying to judge where the engagement at it is going to be. You know what I mean? Like we said, it's a big time for jackets. Kamala stepping out in the Pierre Mons joint for the inauguration. So I'm trying to get on that level with this jacket.
You're trying to get on that level? Okay.
I might have to call complex staff photographer David Cabrera for a little photo shoot or something.
Yeah. One of the guests who I was with in Atlanta, I love that he kept saying, like, you know, I go vintage Nike shopping. And he's like, you know, a lot of them fall apart, but if I could get that one wear off on the gram, it's a thing for me. And like, you know, he would wear them more. He would want to wear them more. But he's like, if I get that one Instagram post off and they fall apart, hey, it could be worse. But I'm trying, hopefully. You know, the other thing that came up, PG Nose came up in an episode. I don't know if it's going to make it. But he came up on video this time. And I don't know if it may get cut, but I'm going to social cut and send it to him.
He came up in a previous episode behind the scenes that I don't know if you guys know about.
For me?
Yeah, for you. It was the Tyra Banks episode. Where you guys talk about the PlayStation Air Force Ones.
Okay.
And I remember, like, you wanted to talk about it on the show. And I guess Flight Club didn't have the shoes at the time, and it was his. And then I had told you, this is before you knew him.
Okay.
And
he was This is a great story.
And he was complaining to me about Flight, cause he wanted X amount of dollars for the shoes to be in the shoe. And he was,
so PG wanted correctly. To rent his shoes to Sneaker Shopping production. Is that right?
Great story, Welty. So Tyra Banks, I had on the show. Stadium Goods didn't have a PlayStation Air Force One, and Tyra Banks had the whole Chris Vidal moment in daytime television where he basically showed off the PlayStation Air Force One. And for the episode with Tyra Banks, we wanted her to hold the PlayStation Air Force One. And I don't think Stadium Goods, they sold out their last one, or it's so rare they didn't have it. So we were looking to get the PlayStation Air Force One to set, and Welty was like, oh, I think I know some guy, but they want money to use it. I was like, they want money to use it for 45 minutes? Like, and I remember I was like, rent it for a shoot?
It makes sense, though, because if you're a sneaker reseller, it's not like your name is going to be attached to that shoe that's on camera. So what are you doing taking like a couple, like it's 45 minutes, but you have to drive there. You have to come back.
We
would
have sent the Uber pool for PG Nose.
No, but like what are you getting out of the situation by having your shoe included in the shoe? No one knows. You know what I mean?
Fair. I remember that day in the office. I probably said like, F that, we're not buying. Yeah. However, now PG Nose, I think would come. He would hand deliver the PlayStation Air Force One. We would go grab some kebabs after the shoot. That's how close we are right now. And PG Nose, I'm hoping I'm going to see him in the next 2 days because
he's got something for you.
Oh, there's a shoe that I've been trying to chase down.
Is it the one we spoke about on here before?
We're getting closer to it.
Busy P?
Yes, we're getting closer to it. Someone's holding out. But getting back to the episode, PG Nose gets a really good shout out because someone's trying to buy the Scars pizza and PG Nose is negotiating.
he's hoarding like 20 pairs. Oh my God. Just for the sake of argument, if you're renting your shoes out, how much are you asking for someone to use your shoes for 45 minutes? How much did he ask?
I think it was like something like $500.
That is wild. PG's wild for that. I'm sorry. We're old friends at this point. $500? Done? Come on. $500?
To be fair, though, if you didn't know the person and you heard that there was going to be like this big show that wants to rent your stuff, wouldn't you kind of go with the head crack?
I don't know, Welty. Welty, you're a good friend. You're a good friend to him.
Where else are you going to get it from?
Welty, you couldn't vouch for your boy. You're close friends with PG. You're close friends with me.
I didn't know about it till after the fact.
He was probably trying to give you $250. Don't lie for some Jersey City dinner. Don't
one
lie.
For you,
that's the
whole. One for me. Yeah. One for you. One, two for me.
Do we have any sneaker news?
Nah, you can find the sneaker news on complex.com/sneakers. Yeah, Soul Collector app. Everything. Always. Download that. You know. Oh, by the way, speaking of downloads, we appreciate you downloading and listening to these. Please do, as you listen to the episode, rate, subscribe, comment. Things like that really help us out. We're trying to take it to the next level.
Absolutely. And I read them all. I saw that we got some more comments on the Apple podcast. Just to let you guys know, we read them all. We appreciate it. Rate, subscribe, leave a comment. And not as a thank you, but next week we have something special planned. We have a live stream.
That's right.
Everyone wants video of the three of us. We've only been teasing the social clips with the Zoom video. Uh-huh. We are having a live stream, and we are going to talk about the Complex Sneaker of the Year book. Some of you are getting them. Some of you are getting the signed copies. We're very happy to see that. But we are going to dissect some of the chapters, and we're going to talk about what went into the making of the book. Also, shout out, it's going to be us three talking about it, but so many other people worked on the book.
Of course.
We are internally thankful. Internally.
That's the eternally.
Yes, exactly. See?
Thankful.
Yes, for everyone who worked on the book. But yeah, live stream. Us three may be together. We may be distanced. And we're hoping to be together in the same room. It'll be good to see these guys two times in 3 weeks. So
might be time to bring out the cold wall jacket, Joe.
Yeah, maybe. You gotta live up to the fit that you wore to the office last time. So
I got my assistant planning things.
I had a realization the other day, thinking about when we were in the office, and sort of it made me think that when we were there, the office kind of felt like it was like an abandoned building to some extent, you know, like it really felt like, I mean, because that's what did happen. Like some event happened and then everyone disappeared for, you know, a long time. It felt like some like post-apocalyptic, like everything's like frozen in time. And then you go back and you're like, not that it was there, but you'd expect like someone's like half drinking cup of coffee to still be on their desk from like, from months ago, which is crazy.
It is crazy. And no one knew that we would be out for this long, but just the routine, just getting on the block and it takes you back like, wow, this feels like a regular work day. And
getting the coffee from the little cart, right, Joe?
Yes, yes. Cannot wait one day when we're back. I miss that office. I miss everyone. So, all right, guys, let's not waste any more time. We have a very special guest today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Our guest on today's podcast has worn many hats in street culture: artist, fashion designer, media mogul, author, and entrepreneur. In 1993, he started a clothing label that would help define modern day streetwear and act as a source of inspiration for prevalent clothing brands that exist today. In 2002, he ventured into the magazine business with an idea that focused on convergence culture in fashion, sports, sneakers, and popular culture. It was a magazine with a flip cover of male and female talent on each issue. Sound familiar? He called it Complex. For the next decade and a half, he would run one of the most successful clothing lines in youth culture while helping turn Complex into a full-fledged media company. In 2011, he added author to his resume by releasing his autobiographical book called Unlabel, Selling You Without Selling Out. Acting as chief brand and creative officer of Complex in 2016, he conceptualized a two-day convention that took everything that the rabid youth audience was consuming online into a real-life experience. You may know it as ComplexCon. Currently, he serves as the chief strategy and creative officer of the XQ Institute. Although we can't rattle off everything on his resume, we're excited to talk about his long journey in this industry. Please welcome to the Complex Sneakers Podcast, our friend, Mark Echo.
Wow. That's a great, I need to, can I get, keep for, can
I'll send it to you. I'll text it to you.
Clip it out.
How you doing? I'm so happy that you're joining, Mark. It's been too long to see you. You know, we FaceTime every now and then, but I'm so happy that me and the guys have an opportunity to chop it up with you.
Good to see you, gentlemen, and everybody working on this podcast. Jasmine, behind the scenes, David, Brendan, Matt, look at you.
It's always a pleasure to see Mark Echo. Strongest jawline in the streetwear game that ever existed.
Yeah, one of the great, you know, it's a good one.
Mark, can you take us back for a second? Can we start back in the 1980s growing up in New Jersey and what you were seeing in terms of sneakers back then? Were sneakers important to you as a young guy in high school?
Oh, my goodness, yes. I mean, they probably drove my interest in, you know, style. You know, when there was a line historically, probably right before the original Air Force One was released in terms of at least basketball, where you know, it's just the basketball shoe was looked at as like a sporting good, you know, mm-hmm. as a sporting good accessory. Like it was a on court only thing, you know, all the sort of rising hero worship that was happening in the NBA and its influence on popular culture was really starting to really come through in the '80s. So, you know, that was sort of a very natural bridge to the curiosity. And I just remember, you know, watching the dynamism of all of these, you know, this sort of Cold Wars between Nike and, and Adidas and Converse and all these brands trying to, you know, win hearts and minds around, you know, basketball shoes effectively. It's funny, you go back and you look at the names of the shoes. They were all so, you know, really was the Cold War. It was
like the weapons.
You know, weapons, Air Force, you know. That was where it all started for me. Obviously, the shell toe Adidas and, you know, the pro model. I like the mid with the Velcro strap. You know, that was my joint. You know, and I remember identifying, obviously, with graffiti. Yeah. And that was sort of a gateway for me into art. Like I was able to, not being an athletic kid, I was into the extreme sport of art, you know, and graffiti was the way to kind of say, well, I'm an emo kid, I'm an emotional creative kid, and identify with this rising new cultural tide. And the way B-boys were illustrated always were like with chunky feet, you know, it was like you drew them almost narrow, like a pyramid, like a triangle, you know. So the body form would get broader towards the feet. Any shoe that gave you that look was the shoe that you were drawn to.
And what were you wearing? Was it one pair that you were messing up when you were doing your art or what? Do you remember?
Oh, my goodness. First of all, my discount shoe game was strong. You know, like, it was like that was, you got to remember too, you go back to those days that were like, the outlet malls were like this rising new thing, you know, and when Nike, if you get to the Nike or Adidas outlet, which were rare back then, I remember there was one in like a couple hours away from where I grew up, and it was like a trip. You'd go there for back to school and maybe, you know, right at the top of spring and you'd find the dead stocks. My purchasing was sort of through a value lens at the time. I didn't always get the aspirational, like brand new, you know, in the latest colorway, Adidas rivalry or so I'd get maybe the slightly off color.
Like, and then mess them up. You would mess them up essentially.
But no, I, you know, it wasn't even like the obsession with like, don't step on my shoes and don't mess them up. I don't think really came until like 88. I think I recall like it being much more taboo, you know, like you wore your shoes, you know, you wore your sneakers.
1988. Was that because of Do the Right Thing specifically or just,
I think, I don't know if it was specifically that. It just, I guess maybe just the innovation and like just the role they started to take in terms of just like dominating the being a signal for your affinity for things like and being a signal on your body a qualifier for your sense of style, things you know you were really drawn to. The sneakers became dominant in, you know, 87, 88, I recall there was just so much innovation and just so many options. And, you know, your closet, your wardrobe was sort of based on that. Not to mention like having a good boot game, you know, which was, you know, equally as important.
Mark, you know, your story is, you know, growing up in Lakewood, New Jersey, in your parents' basement, airbrushing t-shirts. Were you customizing your sneakers at all at that point? Were you ever like painting on them to like give them new colorways?
Oh yeah, I'll never forget. I think it was the first Andre Agassi shoe. What was the model called?
Tech Challenge.
Air Tech Challenge.
Yeah. And I think that year correlates with De La Soul's first album came out.
Yeah.
It was around roughly that same time.
89.
Yeah, or 88, 89, I want to say. And I remember illustrating, getting paint markers and illustrating the, you know, Paz and Dove and the guys on, and Mace on, that were illustrated on the 3 Feet High and Rising album, like on my shoes. And I literally couldn't make it past like the third period of school that day. I remember without being like threatened to have my shoes stolen at least a dozen times. So I remember quickly like having to borrow someone's gym shoes and hide them. Yeah, I definitely was into customizing my shoes.
Were you ever customizing sneakers for anybody else, or that was just a personal thing?
That was kind of a bold move because you didn't have, it wasn't as common back then. I mean, all customization was so dominated by, you know, like sweatshirts and denim jackets. And for whatever reason, it was kind of a rare occasion. And then when I did that, I just remember it becoming like, you know, a thing and people requesting it. And I was very like, oh, I'm not only special, you know. I'm like, well, let's first kind of like get to know each other and do like a jacket or a t-shirt or something, you know. But that was like, I was really heavy into, you know, painting at that time. Heavy into painting and making. And you know, it was my own little lemonade stand, I guess.
Obviously, you were super focused on apparel over sneakers, but when you started Echo, when you started the brand in the early 90s, was there ever any aspiration to work with a sneaker brand at some point? Or, I mean, the collaboration thing was so far out, but were guys on your level thinking about stuff like that back then?
You know, I did. I was so shaped for my own... The things, you know, I didn't feel constrained by sort of the boundaries of, and I didn't really fully understand them, the boundaries or constraints that were sort of somewhat self-assigned by streetwear at the time. I grew up on Polo and, Timberland and would shop at like Dr. J's on Market Street in Newark, or like a VIM, or, you know, like there was a place in Lakewood called Junkies. Like it was called the Family Discount Center or whatever. And it was basically Lakewood's version of like the spot where they cellophane the shoes, and they were on the wall, and, you know, you get like a bomber jacket. And so I wanted to make everything that was in those that I was shopping for. You know, I didn't feel constrained. I didn't know that it's like just focus on t-shirts, or like all you do is draw. So don't dream that big. I looked at Polo and Ralph, and that was my aspiration. That was, you know, and I would be obsessively roaming through the pages of GQ when it was good. You know, back in the day, and I shouldn't say it sounds disparaging, like when it was good.
But no, we got to do the competition, Mark. We got to disparage.
No.
They were so
to their credit, they were the dominant player in men's style. And like back in the day, you know, a magazine was this portal. You know, there was no internet, so you'd pick up those. You know, everything that was crafted on those pages was so precious at the time. It wasn't, it was just a different time. But I remember just being enamored by all of that, you know. And I remember seeing photo shoots of Ralph, like in his ranch or something, and just seeing the spaces. You know, it was like just the spaces that he would portray himself and his brand in, and that sort of like creation of a universe was really dope. So obviously, no constraints, you know, unlimited in terms of what I wanted to do. And I frankly wasn't thinking about collaborations. I was thinking about figuring out how to make it myself. That sort of power of the collaboration hadn't fully certainly when I was starting, hadn't fully articulated itself. You know, go back to 88, 89 when I was really coming up, and then say 90 to 93 is when I was really in sort of biz dev mode, you know, kind of graduating from just this hobby into a business plan. Yeah, I had a shoe drawn, and I had like a Timberland boot, like rip off, and the outsole of the boot was with the lugs, when you would turn it upside down, would just have EC, you know, KO, and it was actually ECHO at the time.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was like formed like these footprints. And I remember I'd make stencils, you know, and I would paint those stencils like wherever if I did, like in New Brunswick, where I was a, you know, the king of the toys I talk about in terms of graffiti. when I was at Rutgers, there was there's the river there,
the Raritan.
Yeah. And where like the crew team would row, and where people would jog and just walk and stroll. Mm-hmm. But there were some banked walls where kids would write graffiti. And I would always, when I would do a piece or something down there, I would, you know, stencil my way to and from, like leaving the bread, you know, it's so corny. But, you know.
You talk about, you know, seeing Ralph in those photo shoots, and then you in 1993 putting together the biz dev, and then, you know, a year later when Supreme starts coming to fruition and is developed, how were you like marrying basically what was going on in the space and not pulling from each things, but kind of playing in that space and seeing what was happening downtown New York, and then having such an appreciation for Ralph?
Well, I think the dominant influencer was Ralph.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember being at my first trade show at the Javits Center, probably around those years when Supreme was just coming up, and when the Stussy Union store was sort of like the dominant area for that sort of downtown streetwear scene, when like Patricia Fields was, you know, the place where you would get that sort of convergence of skate and graffiti culture, you know. But we were all looking at Polo Sport.
Yeah.
Like everyone had a ripoff or a send up or vamping a Polo Sport or a Nautica logo. So like everybody had like the same sort of North Star. I don't even remember thinking about Supreme even in my orbit creatively or as a source. I just didn't have the literacy.
Mm.
You know, I just kind of knew them as a New York brand. I'm one amongst the many different brands in the space, so there wasn't that sort of situational awareness that I think you have in a market when sort of, you know, the everything has sort of filtered out, and you know who the top two or three players are. That wasn't the distance between us and them, them being these sort of, you know, the booths when you go to the convention center that were like two or three stories and were taking up like five rows, was so different, so far away, so distant that I was focused on that gap. I wasn't focused on the couple feet or inches away from my who I thought were my peers. You know, I focused on me versus I wasn't thinking about those sort of near peers. And I think that was kind of peculiar to those guys back in the day, because I remember getting a lot of sort of hate or friction from kind of settling in and feeling like a part of the group of the guys that were coming up at that time, because I was sort of matter of fact about wanting to go big.
Mm.
It's just like, I'm not here to play. Like, I'm here to do something really, like, you know, I want to go big.
Yeah. Let's see how big the ceiling is.
Yeah. In fact, to your question about did you think about making, you know, shoes, I remember we had a lot of the ways that we came up in the space, the royal we, the us of streetwear, who I really think are, we're all connected. We're all completing one another's stories in a lot of way, right? A lot of ways. I really believe that. In order to kind of survive financially, we were a big part of our audience development was international. So Japan, Germany, Australia. So I had a Australian distributor who I was very fond of. And I told them I wanted to make shoes. And I had sketches. And they're pretty fairly well-rendered sketches. And I'll never forget, he came to visit, like we had these sort of like big international sales meetings, not so big, but like it was like at a hotel or something, right? And he brought the first sample prototype. Wow. He just made it. He took my rendering. He said, "You can make shoes." Mm. And he made the first prototype. And he's like, let's partner on this together. It was his pitch. And I didn't understand the economics of it. I didn't know what was involved in tooling a new outsole.
How early on was this in the Echo brand?
Oh, this was very early. This was probably, let's see, we started in 93, probably 97, 98. Okay. And so for like a year, 97 probably, year and a half, I would walk around with that prototype in my backpack.
Okay.
And when I'd be with my peers in the business, I'll never forget. And you could ask him. In fact, there's a gentleman who was one of the founders, or certainly one of the really important executives at a company that was called Mecca, right? It was like a streetwear brand.
Yeah, of course.
And a guy named Tony Shellman. And I forget where we were, and I feel like it was like at a conference or something, and I did a panel. And it was like, and I pulled out the sample, and they were just like, oh. It was like, you got a shoe made. Like, it was like, you know, Pulp Fiction, like what's inside the glowing briefcase. And I still contend it was a good looking shoe. It was more of like a running shoe, and it had a very peculiar last, very bubbly. Yeah, so that gave me the confidence. And and by the way, we tried to pursue getting it made, and we couldn't afford to. And it didn't happen. And so that I had to sort of sideline those aspirations for a few years until, you know, I could find partners to really start making our own product.
Mark, speaking of the early days, I think a lot of people were kind of nostalgic for the early Echo ads that you had. You know, you had people like Common,
sure,
Prodigy, Beat Nuts. I remember having an Echo Beat Nuts t-shirt. Yeah. Were there any memorable stories from like shooting those ads with people like Prodigy or Common back in the day?
So many great memories. My goodness. So many great memories. Prince Paul.
Did you tell him about your De La Soul sneakers?
No. I did get to know him, though, years later. And he's an amazing guy, amazingly talented, and surrounded by like great musical minds. Those early days were very just like ad hoc. You know, it was just like, you know, a page. That's what I was saying before about like, you know, GQ and a magazine, you know. The Source as a magazine was such a central vehicle for communicating to folks in the space. And there weren't really equivalents. So like, you know, media buying, media planning, designing media, it was so powerful, the sort of impact it could have back like pre the internet. And there was a woman who worked for us, named Sandra Mihalenko, who I went to college with, and she was one of my good college, you know, mates, just a ton of fun. And she was a photographer. She studied it. I think she graduated from like the arts college at Rutgers, Mason Gross. And when I was starting, I remember we were just good friends. I remember trying to recruit her to do photo shoots. And it was almost like, before I had production made, I was designing photo shoots. It was really like working backward from the consumer perception.
Like the imagery was the most important thing almost?
That was the forcing function to figure out the rest of the business. MC Search was a very crucial part of helping connect the dots. He came in I forgot exactly how we met or how the dots were connected. Pitched him to help on the marketing, and he really was like a major catalyzer for making introductions to people.
I gotta ask, you know, just since we're on search, did you ever meet Dev Love X, MF Doom back in that day? Because they were connected.
I met MF Doom very briefly at a concert I did in Central Park, a Save the Rhino concert, and De La performed, and he came out as a and did his one that one big record he had with them,
the Rock Cocaine Flow.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, but not in the KMD days with Search and all that.
No. And Search was and still remains a really an amazingly good guy with a giant heart and great connector and just great instincts, and really saw where I was trying to push it and take it. And I would just be like, Search, I want to meet Q-Tip. And he just was a relentless network. He'd be like, okay, we're going to make that happen. It was like the way we would do shoots back then is like we would just show up at their crib. You have to understand, it's like with Stretch and Bobbito. When I remember going to the shoot Stretch and Bob, and we went to, I believe it was Stretch's apartment. And it was kind of like Search would be like, yeah, I'm coming. We're going to do that, like, bring you some gear. And then we'd show up with cameras and be like, go ahead, put this shit on. Let's go. We would just,
you know. you painted Stretch? For press.
You know, and they'd be like, okay.
You talk about photo shoots, and let's get to 2002. Which May of 2002, the premiere issue of Complex, and you have Nas and Uncle Junior,
Dominic Chianese,
photographed by Jonathan Mannin. Yes. And it just, you still look at that image, and it's, to be honest, it was 2002, but it's something that I think we always throw around convergence culture, but it's really, it built the DNA of Complex, and it's something that we strive to do every day at work. Still, talk about conceptualizing Complex, talk about that first cover, and just in general launching this magazine. I'm sure everyone on the newsstand saw for so many years, and to this day you see right at the top Mark Echo's Complex. So let's get to that.
It was a funny the story of me in the photo shoots and that sort of building with that imagery first and working your way backwards is almost the same way I started the magazine. Mm. It's almost the same way I started pretty much everything. Like I work backward from like the devices that could get consensus so groups could agree what it could be. You got to get past like squinting, you know, you got to get past like, I got to get you more to full eyes open to see it. And then people could believe it. Right. And you know, as the brand was growing, I was doing lots of media buying, and obviously the role of the advertisements were a material part of the business. And as the business expanded, I expanded into the different arenas of different, you know, interest areas. And I found as a media buyer buying, let's say I wanted to buy the vertical of men's fashion, it was a very narrow, you could go from like details on the spectrum of details to like GQ, right? Mm-hmm. You know, where it was really about like the clothing, the accessories, and not just like the sort of philosophy of being a man, like Esquire or something, you know, it was like details, GQ. Then in music, there was a spectrum. So in hip hop, there was, you know, XXL, The Source, and you could work your way through Vibe to Spin, to, you know, I don't think we really ever advertised in Rolling Stone, but it was like on that spectrum of like alternative to hip hop. So, you know, and you keep going down the supermarket aisles of magazines, you know, video gaming, sports, right? That could be, you know, there was the great job that was happening at Slam in terms of that they were, I believe, early conversion in a lot of ways too. Mm-hmm. Convergence, all the way to, let's say, the hardcore, you know, technical X's and O's, hardcore details of the fandom. So I just looked at that and I was like, where's the magazine that sort of, you put these all like mix them in a mixing bowl together, what could that be? And I just started visualizing that for probably a 2 or 3 year period. So it wasn't like this instant control P, run to the, you know, the Canon printer and it's on the other side. It was a proper 3-4 year journey. And I, first thing was to get to the name, and I initially had called it Climate.
Okay.
And, cause it was about like what's happening in space and, you know, in the atmosphere, right. In culture, in the climate. And I had been marketing echo.complex like on my, gear, because that was when the first .com boom was, and obviously, you know, to be have a .com was a big deal, even though it was so small. So, you know, small, there's no really ways to measure like the way that you can today, that sort of feedback loop of measurement and inquiry and how successful, like heat mapping your success wasn't obvious. But nonetheless, I was heavy on the promo of that. So again, it's like working backwards from visualizing it. Started a couldn't get the Climate name, trademark issues. We're debating names. And we, you know, in a repertoire of names, it's like, oh, wow, well, we used echo.complex. We used to call the South River office the complex, right? That was okay. The nickname for it, right? And that's where we incubated the magazine. Gentleman by the name of Alan Kett, a gentleman who's came from the graffiti world, but actually was a publisher himself with a magazine called Stress Magazine. And Alan was an incredibly important friend and consigliere to understanding what the opportunity could be in the publishing space. So he was heavily consulting and helping shape it. There was my first real kind of business hires well before we launched the magazine. They were a boyfriend girlfriend couple. Now they're just friends, obviously, and they're married with their different lives. There's a guy named Ben White and a woman named Tina M. And they had a platform that was called platform.network. platform.network. And that was like radical, because it was like, it's hard enough to get people to go to .com, yet alone .net, you know?
Yeah.
They were early e-commerce and they had a great sensibility of digital. There were a lot of people that came through the infrastructure and sort of helped shape and hone what this could be. And we initially, it was just a CD-ROM, you know, that we would ship on the gear.
Yeah.
And we were promoting, sign up for your first free issue of Complex, you know, send it and prepaid, you know, postage card, like as a hang tag. And every Friday, man, when we get that drop off from the P.O. box, I'm talking thousands and I mean, we must have gotten 200,000 or 300,000. I'm not even kidding. Addresses to help us launch. So before we printed page one, before we even had we knew it was going to be on the cover. We were out there prototyping and putting it out in the universe. Just that whole, like, you just put it out there, man. Put it in the universe. And people were more patient back then, too. You know, there was no Twitter to get, like, housed on, you know, or sunned and, like, shamed on. So the distance between the audience that was, like, in waiting, like, promise that thing, and us being able to hear that was quite far. So we had a lot of permission for, you know, a couple of years. So we just did, you know, it was a lot of heavy duty incubating. And then we came to that first issue. It was finally real. And we really assembled. I remember we were moving our Echo offices on one location on Broadway that was much smaller. I can't remember the exact street address. I want to say it was in the 700s or something. And we were moving to another showroom that was like 3 or 4 floors. We were expanding. We were really committed to moving out of New Jersey. And we took the old showroom and we converted that to the first Complex offices.
You had said that anyone who worked in that space during that era had early conversations with Kanye West about clothing to some extent. Kanye, obviously, you know, guest editor at Complex, a lot of stories about him coming through. Did you have any like early sneaker conversations with Kanye that you remember about him wanting to make footwear?
Oh, sure. First time I met Kanye was through Coltrane Curtis.
Okay. Shouts to Coltrane.
Legend. Yeah, shouts to like my brother from another mother, Coltrane Curtis, who was one of the most important people in my professional journey, really helped shape and stretch our creative ambition and really helped build so much inside of the organization. From always would push me in my pursuits. So when I would bring up something like the magazine, he's like, yeah, you could definitely do it. The Coltrane was just like, you know, gave you that energy to say, you got to go for it. From that to video games to it, he was always supportive no matter what I brought, what hair, brain, scheme I would bring to him. I could always have a creative volley with him to stretch the idea and him not like be cynical about it. Mm. But I did a fashion show in Bryant Park. Forget what show it was. I think it might have been my Dreamnasium show. He was helping bring people to the show, like talent and seating the first couple rows. And I remember right after the show, him making the introduction to me. And it just was like, oh, who's this plain guy? You know, I want you to meet Kanye West. And, you know, he's produced a bunch of records for Jay-Z, you know, and that's how he was introduced. And I remember him just like tunnel vision. Like the other people, you give him a pound, dap you up, cool. He just was like, how do you do this? You know, and every time I had an interface with Kanye, it was always like that. I remember years later at E3 when I was launching Getting Up in LA at the E3 video game convention. We had a booth outside and we were showing Getting Up. He just was there as a attendee. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time I had a real deep connection with him. We walked the show together. Just, you know, took it all in. And he was just, I remember, he's like, when you say you're going to make something, you actually do it. I remember him saying that to me and giving me props for that. And I've always appreciated that. So whenever he would express his desire to want to do stuff, it was a serious conversation. It was sort of that same energy of like, you can do it.
Do you remember when you first saw his Nike Air Yeezy sneakers?
Yeah, I was at probably the Complex offices.
Yeah, Complex, yeah. And we had the exclusive on those.
Yeah.
I think they came with an NDA and like a bag hand delivered to the office. But we were the exclusive kind of partner rolling those out. Not partner, but the first Kanye drop. The first time you saw real good photos was in Complex magazine. I remember Bradley working on them.
Yeah, I remember in our Chelsea offices. He would come in and hang out and actually design.
Really?
And I remember there was on the fourth or fifth floor, there was this one war, we used to call it the war room, and it just was covered and paneled. It was like an ugly room, no windows, an interior of the building. And he would just post up, take an Ethernet, and I don't even know who he was potentially even there with. I want to say like, you know, maybe Don C or John Monopoly or I remember seeing drawings. He would have just drawings of shoes. Lots of running shoes, I remember. Mm-hmm. All color blocked and clearly influenced by, you know, sort of all of us. We play in that common vernacular. It's like interesting. You look at like Virgil's Louis Vuitton trainer. Shoe, the basketball shoe, right? Mm-hmm. What is that but not, I know it's going to sound crazy, but what the old Troop shoe was. Mm-hmm. Remember Troop?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Troop,
yeah.
What was interesting about Troop, Troop was like this weird stepchild of a brand. Like, I don't know the genesis of how it got made, who was behind, I don't know, none of that matters. What mattered was the design vernacular for me, right? Mm-hmm. And here was like, it's one part Fila, is one part Adidas rivalry, all these extra components, not constrained by any team colorway. Like it could color itself in colors that weren't necessarily of a team nature. Borrowing from high, like from Gucci. Like I remember the tongue label was like this all heraldry and, you know, gold you know,
Regal, right?
And, you know, rolling, you know, and it was kind of ugly. I mean, but there's something beautiful in the ugliness, you mm-hmm. know, mm-hmm. and because it was not constrained in its design. Yeah. So, you know, you look at like an LV trainer and it's sort of like that. It's come full circle, but now it's actually finally done at the level of finish mm. and deference for the making, the composition, right? Like for end to end, like how it was labored, right? How it was crafted. And it says like, respect my design, mm-hmm. right? But that journey to have to go from before, like all, like, so I'm saying all of us are connected. We're all connected. When you zoom out, what this sort of cohort of entrepreneurs, men and women, some owners, some just hard workers, you know, the collaborators, what we did to sort of reshape and recontour the industry and change the parameters of what luxury means and who gets to play in that space, right, is just so powerful. So powerful. And it all came from like being a bunch of doofuses that were just geeking out on like, you know, are those Converse weapons? You know, yeah. are those... Mm-hmm. You know, are those spot built? What was the Xavier McDaniel?
Yeah.
What were those called? The Express Highs, mm-hmm, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, like that. It didn't even make sense from a design point of view. It was like they marketed as performance. There's no performance value. It just looked like a fucking
spaceship, you know, right?
It looked like it landed.
Yeah.
What I mean? It was like some, you know, Japanese mech like robot, blah, 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 you know, like is the illest.
One of my biggest regrets, I was telling these guys before you got on, there was a Vans Vault party downtown one night, and Kanye, I went to the Vans Vault party. It was like in some basement, grungy thing, and I'm getting text messages. Kanye's at the office. Him and Consequence came through to your office and like had like a makeshift performance, and I was the biggest Kanye stan. I remember he had the Good Music Baby t-shirt. If you go back to it, the first Good Music logo was the baby, and I remember, wait, Kanye's at Mark Echo's office right now, and he would just pop up. Another time I remember he popped up in the Christopher Bevins jacket. Do you remember those jackets?
Yes.
Christopher Bevins, who you worked with,
yes.
Kanye had like this one-of-one Christopher Bevins jacket, and I just remember walking past just a glimpse of Kanye. But yeah, his office visits always were a special day for sure.
Yeah. Everybody was pursuing, you didn't know it at the time. You thought it was just as simple as like, oh, we're trying to just, you know, make atoms, you know, we're making stuff.
Yeah.
You know, we're making objects. Well, there was so much more than that that was going on, really. It was really, but we couldn't articulate it that way. I don't think. Maybe it was like a guttural thing, but those were great times. And you know, it's interesting how the business has changed now, the dynamics of the business, you know, and opportunities or where they are and where they lack in the market, and just all the disruptions with e-commerce and retail. It's you know, there's a lot of hopefully fledgling entrepreneurs or someone who's got an itch to design listening to this that you know, pursues those opportunities despite it being seeming hard. You know, it's only as hard as you believe it is.
Mark, I want to talk too about just how big the Echo empire was at the time, because if I recall correctly, G-Unit clothing was also a part of Echo, and G-Unit had that big Reebok deal. Did you touch that at all? Were you involved at all in this massive deal between G-Unit and Reebok to make sneakers?
No, in fact, it was very much to their credit. That was very much, they had that sort of premeditated.
Okay.
And they had figured out to rest in peace, Chris Lighty. Mm-hmm. But I remember that was a part of what gave them sort of the, made them feel bullish in the market. They had this sort of amazing sort of 1, 2, 3, 4 knockout punches that were coming into the market between,
just like with the music, right?
Yeah. Like it was totally a calculated four dimensional chess they were playing. And so when we did our deal, it was, the focus was just on apparel. Mm-hmm. I think men's and women's apparel, and then we helped get them into kids' apparel, right? We sort of like used our same infrastructure or licensing relationships that we had to scale them up very quick. It was explosive growth. You know, you rewind back to that, Coltrane was in there, a guy named Matt Fontana, who was working in my marketing group, who was a very, very shrewd marketer, was in the midst of that. And just it happened from 50 just being at an Echo shoot, in an Echo ad, and him sort of saying like, one day I'm going to have my own clothing company. It was just really like, it was like that. And I remember being in South River before we fully moved, because we kept the South River office, and I would kind of, since I lived in Jersey, I would do, let's say, 2 days in Jersey, 3 days in New York. And I remember Lighty coming to the offices, and James Cruz, you know, coming through the South River offices, seeing our infrastructure, seeing, you know, sharing. And we just, you know, hitched up and like, let's do it. Let's do this.
Mark,
that was an amazing ride. I mean, it really represents about this much time, I have to be honest, because at that time in my life, in my career, it was just going so fast. I mean, it was like, I don't know that there was a track under the caboose, you know, like we were rolling.
Crazy.
So
just 50 on TRL with the Echo Clothing G-Unit t-shirts in one time.
It was amazing. Yeah. And I always loved interfacing with him. I always had great experiences interfacing. I have a lot of respect for how, like I said, it's four-dimensional chess. He was a planner. He portrayed this spontaneous thing, but a guy knew what he was doing.
Mark, you ended up also acquiring Zoo York, you know, legendary New York skate brand. Early on, they ended up doing a Nike SB collab. Was that something that you were involved in at all? I know that was like right around the time frame of you.
It was around the same window. Yeah, it was around the same window. No, to their credit, and to Eli and Rodney, the original founders, those were their relationships. And much like Echo in its early days, they reminded me a lot of the similar kind of distribution strategies, where there was a lot of dependency on Japanese distributors, German distributors, to sort of really make up the composition of their business. And those were those early Nike SB days, and they were just in that flow. And I remember those, they're like kind of like a tobacco topi. Yep. Remind me a lot of the same colorway as the Travis Scott Jordan, right? And a lot of color, like from a palette point of view.
Totally. Yep.
That was an interesting time. People were obsessed with that silhouette of shoe.
Did you fall into that rabbit hole, Mark?
Oh, yeah.
You had every SB?
I had, It was like an understood thing between all my marketing team knew that they had permission on the credit card, as long as they brought back size 11 and a half.
They were buying SBs on the company card for you, Mark?
Oh, yeah, man. Oh, yeah.
Just on go.
Yeah. It was like, who could bring back the wild shit for me? And my office, I was like, it was like some Kubrick shit. I had my office built where it was like a bowling alley. I sat at the end, and I had these glass paneled walls in South River, right and left. Matt Fontana helped me design it. And I would go to, you know, these are the years when, man, I would go into Hong Kong and into Japan, South Korea, and those years were as influential to me and were really shaping my point of view on like on style. Mm-hmm. I think you have to give a lot of credit to what the vinyl art movement did, like the vinyl toy art, like Michael Lau, the Gardner action figures.
Had his own Nike SB too.
Yeah, I mean, that had a major influence on sort of us seeing ourselves as art, like, and seeing the shoe as art, like the idea of the toy as art, sort of trafficking in all of this nostalgia, right? Like the nostalgia of the hero worship of basketball, Michael Jordan, right? Mm-hmm. The nostalgia of like G.I. Joe toys, which, you know, I don't really remember playing with, but I remember the advertisements, you know, the nostalgia but like portraying it as art, you know, and like portraying the figures in this scene, the people, the actors as figures. And there was something kind of magical about that. And I kind of just saw myself in all of that. And I wanted to be a part of that. And, you know, when you asked about the complex, how complex it came to be, I have to give I got to put a special sort of pin in that part of the history, because Popeye magazine, you know, magazines that, like, you know, would do all these obsessive sort of encyclopedic overview of, like, you know, Levi's or Champion sweatshirts.
It's almost like a catalog, just an archive.
Yeah, that was a big influence. That was a big influence on Complex. Huge influence in my model.
Talking about your office, I remember you had the black and red in the glass case. Was there anything special about that one?
The black and red
Jordan 1.
Not really that special.
Okay.
No.
I thought maybe it was a gift or something, but I remember always seeing that.
I actually found that in a case when I was cleaning up a couple years ago. I was like, this is not that special of a release.
I thought MJ
to you personally.
Like, this shit might have come straight up from, like, you know, the locker, the Foot Locker.
The 34th Street Foot Locker?
Nothing wrong with that.
No, nothing at all wrong with that. Are you kidding me? Yeah. Nothing, zero wrong with that.
Mark, funny story. The first time I actually met you was at the 23rd Street office, where you had to go up the elevator shaft, and there was like a passcode to get into the door. It was like a number. I was an intern at the time, and I had forgotten the number code. So I'm waiting for someone to come in and let me in through the buzzer or whatever that I had recognized. And out comes Mark Echo. So it's my whole, like, Devil Wears Prada moment where I'm like, oh, shit. Like, the funny part about it is how you approached me. You're like, who are you here to see? It was, like, very serious. And I was like, oh, I'm here to see Gian, who was the style editor at the time. And you're like, okay. And then you just look me dead in the eyes and say, don't steal any of my shit. And then just walked on, because I guess you had like a cause print, like, stolen from your office by like some undercover sort of, you know.
Oh, Louis BTM, right?
Yeah, who the kid was that actually stole it? I don't know, but I have a photo of him. Yeah, I've had some shit stolen. You know, like, it was another thing. Like, I would display really good art and just, like, because it was like for the family, for the people, you know.
Yeah.
And I wasn't like, we put it in like hallways to bathrooms and, you know, like, it was in like general areas. But yeah, there was a piece that in fact sat right in front of the foyer or a little egress between the men's and women's bathrooms on the floor where my office was. And I guess he came in there somehow, probably was let in by someone at Complex or from Echo. We don't know for sure. And broke the glass, took the print. And it was Kate Moss. Yeah. Bus, it's like a bus kiosk sign. And it was painted on the inverted side, like Cause would, you know, Brian would like turn it inside out and then illustrate on top of it like one of his sperm, you know, skull characters. So this was early days. And he would go and I guess change the locks or something on these bus kiosks. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the prints. And I actually got it from an auction. It was a fundraising auction, I think. And Alan Kett actually helped me procure it, if I recall properly. But yeah, it was gone. And what the fuck, right? Mm. So I'm like, I asked security guy, I'm like, get me footage. Is there any footage? There's got to be footage. And sure enough, there's this footage of this kid. I forget who the kid was that was like a graffiti artist, but he had, it looked like a Beastie Boys video. It looked like Sabotage. And like, I thought it was like a put on, you know, this picture of him like looking up at the security camera, holding the poster in
almost winking, right?
It and was he had a mustache, so maybe Welty. Did you have a mustache back then? Maybe there was
no,
a little.
He had a Welty mustache.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's why maybe.
No, it was more like Brandon's mustache. It was like thinner.
I'm not down with BTM. Don't put me in there.
All right. So, yeah, I was pissed.
Yeah.
And then people thought it was a stunt. They thought I did it like for attention.
But you were known, you were doing some stunts back in the day that maybe people thought, but this was different. I remember looking at that.
This was not a stunt. This someone came in and took, I felt violated. And so I posted, it's probably one of the only things I ever posted to Facebook. I don't even know how to use Facebook. It was by recommendation of like my communications guy to post the image. So maybe that would drum up some awareness to smoke out where the piece is. And sure enough, that helped because in the mail, it got shipped back to me, returned.
You recovered it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he got it back. I remember that.
Mark, was Cause a contemporary of yours? You guys are around the same age, came up in Jersey. Did you see each other a lot in the 90s?
Not really. I think I always thought of him coming into the space a little bit after I was in there, but I can't definitively say that. In terms of his notoriety, seemed to be rising later on. But again, I haven't overlaid a Venn diagram.
Yeah.
When I did Getting Up, he was one of the first people I wanted to talk to about it and wanted to get him involved in some capacity. And, and he lent his art to it. He was very generous. A lot of artists, Futura, Shepard Fairey, you know, all the OGs, you know,
Stash,
you know, Is the Wiz, Cope, you know, all the OGs. So that was a super dope experience.
Mark, let's get to 2016. You know, we have limited time, but we have to talk 2016 moonshot. You know, I heard the term moonshot being thrown around the office and I didn't even know what it means. And it was like, just big idea, big ideas. And you were pushing us to do that. You were pushing us think really big ideas, which you kind of done throughout your career. And 2016 Complex Con.
Yeah,
the first Complex Con. Let's get into Complex Con before we go, and how you thought about that, and those first years, and it's such a successful brand, and man, I just remember walking the floor with you before it started, and I was like, I can't believe this fucking happened. I can't believe this.
Emotional. I remember that.
Yes, me and you walking. I remember. Yeah. I was like,
how did this happen? Emotion.
Yes, yes. Me. I didn't want to say it, but yes.
Yeah, you can say it. I don't. Yeah. I'm not afraid to cry.
No, and I loved it. I remember like just looking at you and being like, how the fuck did this happen?
And you were crying. I remember walking around, and it was like. Like I didn't even give a fuck that I was like you know, boogies and tears huffing. Right. People are looking at me like, what the fuck is wrong with him? And my wife came and saw me. She's like, calm down, calm down. It's like, I can't believe we actually pulled this shit off. You know?
Crazy.
You know?
So talk about that and the response to it, and like seeing the youth culture turn out and the concert and the drops those first years.
Oh man, it was such a special. It was a community effort. It was really the, again, you have to start backwards from past squinting, right? So mm-hmm. you got to get past squinting. I got to take that blurry image, make it concrete. So we put together a video, and I obsessively worked on that video in like a closet somewhere in the office. And it was like my lab. And a lot of this was persuading people to see it.
Yeah.
Internally, because
it's true.
It was so out of our comfort zone. And that's one of the things about the business that's really, that was hard, particularly hard at Complex, but beautiful, because the organization has a tremendous amount of elasticity and capacity to want to sort of stretch itself, or at least when pushed, stretch and go along with it. You know, some organizations become so recalcitrant and bureaucratic. I think anything with more than 10 people does.
Totally.
It doesn't matter what it is. If it's a team of, a basketball team, or if it's a doctor's office or a magazine or so a lot of it was just about persuading folks to see the potential opportunity. Like I said, we're just completing our history. Like when I see the royal us, the folks that have really come up with beauty and an intent of love and creation in their hearts to want to make something from nothing, to want to elevate what we have as a collective together to create more gravity for ourselves, more of a centeredness, and to celebrate each other. It's not competing. It's yes, competition is a real thing, but I have love in my heart for someone else that's doing something I aspire to do better than I do. It's like, it's why I like being around people that I feel that are smarter than me, right? That complement a blind spot I might have, or help me overcome a blind spot, or so I really approached ComplexCon as like a love festival. Mm-hmm. I really did. Mm-hmm. And at that time in my life too, I was, and I still remain, very spiritual, right? So like mm-hmm. I was really channeling the need for us across brands as creators inside of big industry, if you were inside of Nike, Adidas, mm-hmm. whatever, like to come together. Now, if we rewind to that time, the background politics, there was a lot of really bad, obviously state sanctioned violence against Black folks happening in the universe, and certainly in America. And that was, and we were in a political cycle, ironically, it was before the last election cycle. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of in the ether, and this desire to want to bring everyone together. Some cynically would say, well, it's just like a mall, right? It was just like but you know what? These are people making stuff, mm-hmm. independent creators with headwinds of e-commerce, headwinds of a fractured media ecosystem, but like-minded. How do we get everyone together? How do we show the power of this community of people, the diversity, the strength in it, right? And how do we treat it with the sort of deference and elevate it that the same community in the Valley, in Silicon Valley, would amongst themselves as creators, or mm-hmm. the music elite would at a South by Southwest, right? Yeah. Like, what gives them permission to do that and not us, right? And that was my thinking, you know. And that was the pitch I would give. That was my intention. That's where my heart was. I wanted to make something special for people. I wanted to create access, wanted to put information out there. Having come up even though I didn't get as much out of it, but coming up and going early on to one of my first experiences was Jack the Rapper, in it, you know, driving down to Atlanta, Georgia, you know, from New Jersey with my friends, you know, to show my first trade show was at the basement floor of the Peachtree Hilton or whatever the fuck it was, you know, mm-hmm. in Atlanta, airbrushing, you know, with Tupac walking by, like that was the, I wanted to bring that energy, you know? And we did it, and it was a we, thing. And I attribute the success to a selflessness. You really had to kind of like check your humility at the door to pull the thing off, you know, like getting Pharrell involved was, I from forever grateful to him, and I love him dearly, and his whole team, Robbie Wells and Alex DePersia and all the amazing people in his orbit, his wife, his mom, that were so, you know, his management, Ron, they were just so, they're great partners. You know, they're great. And Tekashi brought an energy.
Yeah,
definitely.
You know, and it was just, man, you know, like that alchemy. You know, when you write a business plan, you gotta think about the alchemy of the characters, man. Like the alchemy that, like, there's the plan, there's the X's and O's, the blocking and tackling that you could see within the boxes in the spreadsheet. And then there's that stuff that's in between the boxes that you don't, that stuff matters.
Yeah.
You know, and it's really hard to, it was one of those things where God, the universe, people's egos were at a place where they were able to check that out. Like, everyone came together. This is before Virgil was signed to, you know, LV, you know, those guys were they were the shepherds. They were the leading. They were like, it was for them.
Yep.
It wasn't for us. It wasn't for us, and it was for the audience. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's what it should be, and I will never soon forget those amazing experiences. It was a real blessing, and then to see it all come together. Like, I remember walking the floor with you and Cuddy.
Yes.
And Noah.
Yes.
That was crazy. We were worried for Cuddy, you know?
I know. Like, security. It was crazy. We had to get security, and it was, man, what a great, great memory.
Before we go, one of the things I just wanted to ask you, actually another person who did make an appearance at Complex Con, Kobe Bryant, but you did a 2009 cover story video and you know,
I can't find that video. You know, I saw
it. The video is down. I had to go on the Wayback Machine on the internet and type in the URL and find the old complex.com background came up and everything.
Did the video come up or no?
No, the video is off the internet.
We'll find it. We got to find that.
You got to find that video. I love it.
You end up talking. First, you asked Kobe to have a push-up contest with you. He won't do it. And then you end up talking to him a lot about the Kobe 4 on Nike, his first low top shoe. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I want to shout out Noah for making that happen, allowing that to happen. He was very generous with that, because I was always sensitive. Like, I wanted to figure out ways to create a vector that intersected with the magazine, but not to be so overbearing where I would squelch any of the creative ambition of the editorial team. Mm-hmm. And that was always a delicate thing to balance. And Noah and Rich gave me the space for opportunities like that. And when I would express interest in wanting to do something collaborative, they're like, sure. And they would work with me. And so first I want to hold space for that. I think that's important. That was a great experience. Kobe was someone who was, and the editorial insight from Noah and team at the time was this sort of like, you know, there was a slight like, Kobe, people forget, like, or people maybe don't forget, but like, he wasn't liked. People hated on him. They were like, they were like fugazi. Like, you know, like, they were just not nice. I felt that he really was a real guy that day and was vulnerable. And I think I was in like a weird fitness kick, and because I'm not good on camera, I had like some nervous fit of energy where I was like, oh, let's do a push-up cut, like some stupid thing. Like, let me just embarrass myself. Maybe that'll maybe make him like me. But he didn't need any of that. And I remember him talking about, I remember asking him what keeps him up at night. And I remember him talking about like having to like clean up the dog shit in his house.
The quote is amazing. The quote is amazing. He's like, dog shit. I hate dog shit. And there's like two paragraphs. Kobe Bryant talking about his disdain for German Shepherd shit in his yard.
Yeah, I've got two dogs. He's talking about his German Shepherds. That's right. And I've got two. And sometimes I'll babysit my friend's dog. So I'll have up to four. So I know what the fuck he means. You know, like you got like a fully functioning house with infrastructure, kids, teenagers that should be cleaning the shit up that don't. And then somehow dad's out there with the pooper scooper. Mm. And there's a lot of days where I'm like, you know what the fuck? I hate to, but you know what? That just brought him down to like, oh, he's like us.
Here's I got to give you the quote. I got to give you the quote, Mark, because I have it here. Kobe. So you said, you asked Kobe, you said, talk to me about a private failure that wasn't in the headlines, a thing that just keeps you up at night, something people can relate to. Not necessarily a public thing, but a thing you twist and turn over. And Kobe Bryant says back to you, it's a 2009 Complex cover story, dog shit. Like, I hate dog shit. I have a dog and I do not clean the crap outside. It's a phobia. It drives me crazy. You wake up in the morning and you think, damn, this big old German Shepherd probably just took a crap outside in the yard and I got to wake up and pick it up. That is something that keeps me tossing and turning.
Oh, God. He went on. I remember he also talked about, he admitted to injury, and he would talk about plantar fasciitis. He talked about plantar fasciitis and just waking up and being tight and like feeling like, and you just got to like go.
Feeling like dog shit.
He had a good years ahead of him after that still. Yeah. God bless him, man. Rest in peace.
Mark, thank you so much for giving us your time. You know, we say it a lot, but we're going to definitely need a part two. We only scratched the surface and,
oh no, come on.
Yeah. Yeah. We're definitely going to need to catch up, but it was great seeing you. Great hearing your stories and, so close to you, but hearing the history, always a pleasure.
Well, thank you for giving me, holding the space and reaching out for me to be a part of it and get me out of my dustbin and, you know, brushing me off. That's always nice. I appreciate that. Yeah. Nice to see you gentlemen and Jasmine and David. Thank you. And I hope people enjoy this. God bless you.
Definitely, man. Miss you, bud. Thank you, Mark. Hope to talk to you soon. See you
soon.
Thanks,
Mark. Yeah, hope to see you teary-eyed on the floor of Complex Gone sometime in the future.
Oh, we will, my friend. We will.
Yes, definitely.
Next time, gents.
Our producer is Dave Matthews. Our associate producer is Jasmine Plata. Sound engineering done by Kyle Garvey. Special thanks to Jennifer Stewart and Shiva Bayet. The Complex Sneakers Podcast is a production of the Complex Podcast Network.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go Facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.